Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. In the fall of 2022, water levels on the Mississippi River reached the lowest in a decade, temporarily halting the flow of downbound bulk farm products that are so important to our international trade. To learn more about the causes and consequences and responses to such disruption, we're talking with Mike Steenhoek, who is Executive Director of the Soy Transportation Coalition. Mike is a member of the U.S. Department of Commerce Advisory Committee on Supply Chain Competitiveness, the Transportation Research Board Committee on Inland Water Transportation, and the Iowa Department of Transportation Freight Advisory Council. Mike earned both his undergraduate degree and his MBA from the University of Iowa. Mike, can you tell us just what did happen in the Mississippi Valley in the fall of 2022?
Well, you know, those who are routinely engaged in barge transportation and adjacent to the inland waterway system, they know that there can be variability to water levels. But what we saw in the fall of 2022 was a pretty extreme version of that, where we saw historically low water levels due to a pretty elongated drought that not just was in 2022, but also had materialized in 2021 as well. So this is something that was building, and we really saw it all come to roost in the fall of 2022, and where you had historically low water levels throughout the system, particularly in areas like Memphis, Tennessee, St. Louis. That kind of corridor was very adversely affected, and it had a consequence on barge transportation with decreased water depth that barges could enjoy. So that meant they had to decrease the amount of freight that was loaded into those barges, and they also had to diminish the width of their barge tows or flotillas because the channel had narrowed due to low water conditions. That just had a pretty significant impact on the efficiency of barge transportation. Barge transportation is very good at moving a lot of product long distances in an economical manner, but when all of a sudden you can't put as much into the barge and you can't attach as many barges together, that drastically diminishes the economics of barge transportation and the industries that utilize it.
So as you described it, this is not new, but this is worse than typical.
It is, yeah. You know, again, it's kind of table stakes. If you're going to use the river for transportation, you know that there's going to be some areas where water levels will be high, other years where water levels will be low. And then, of course, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico, you've got hurricane activity that can often materialize and throw wrenches in your plans. But this was quite unique. People who had lived next to the river, throughout their entire lives, providing testimonies that they'd never seen that kind of water levels. And, just going back to, the data from the U.S. government on river gauges throughout the system, we hadn't seen such low water conditions, since the mid to late 1980s.
So what are the responses? I mean, my understanding is the Army Corps of Engineers has a target depth that it wants to maintain of 9 feet of water. Apparently, they couldn't do it. So who changes, who responds, and how?
That's the real challenge, because so much of this is produced by Mother Nature, and not a whole lot you can do about coercing Mother Nature into complying with our plans. But one thing that we certainly can do is we can make ourselves more resilient. We can do things on the front end and also in response to these kind of natural disasters that certainly doesn't vitiate the consequences of Mother Nature, but it can certainly moderate them. And things like making sure we're doing a good job with not just dredging in response to natural disasters or challenges, but also you can do it on the front end. Making sure that you've got the equipment positioned where it needs to be, making sure you have abundant equipment One of the things that frustrates me is that we as a nation, we do a relatively commendable job in responding to disasters. But we don't do as good of a job in anticipating them and being on the front end of them to really help mitigate the consequences of those things. So it is something that, you know, that remains a concern. Ironically, 6 months after the low water conditions on the river, we were all of a sudden talking about high water conditions on the upper Mississippi River. So it can fluctuate quite dramatically. But yes, there are certain things that you can do to build more resilience into the system when Mother Nature decides to be uncooperative.
So is it possible for the Army Corps of Engineers to get a little bit more ahead of the game?
Well, I think that's something that, you know, with the Corps of Engineers, I think, you know, all, you know, federal agencies can certainly do that, and the Corps, you know, certainly is one of them. I think, you know, a lot of it can be encouraged by Congress. One of the frustrations I have with congressional behavior is, you know, we have these big goals to do these very capital intensive projects and do these really big infrastructure initiatives, but yet Congress doesn't provide a predictable supply of investment to really execute on that mission. And so a lot of that funding tends to come in, it comes in dribs and drabs and without a lot of long-term predictability. So it really kind of causes people to be a little trigger shy, the government agencies, on doing some of these very expensive projects if they don't have the certainty that it'll be funded to its duration. So I think Congress certainly has a real role to play in this as well. If everything you're doing is myopic and limited and local and parochial, then you can afford to be very short term in your funding allocation, doing things for just a year or just for 2 years. But when you're talking about very expensive projects and infrastructure assets that will provide benefit to us for decades, then you better make sure that you've got a funding strategy that matches up with that asset. And right now, we don't do that very well.
My understanding is that funding for the waterway system, about half of that is congressional appropriations. And if that's so, then you're really tied to kind of short-term politics.
Yeah, and that's really a real frustration. I had the opportunity a number of years ago to testify at a congressional hearing. And one of my comments was, if I were to design a funding approach that would result in guaranteed cost overruns and project extensions, I would design the system we have in place. We shouldn't view a lot of these cost overruns or project delays as unintentional consequences. They're actually predictable outcomes, because when you fund things a certain way, you're going to end up getting that. You have a project that's going to take a decade to build, but then you only have guaranteed funding for 1 year of that work. Well, what that means is you're not going to purchase 10 years worth of steel. You're not going to purchase 10 years worth of concrete. You're not going to secure 10 years worth of equipment. You're only going to match that up with your funding certainty. So what happens is, you know, that 1 year is over and you may not have confidence in funding for year two. Well, then all of that equipment and that manpower goes to another project, and then maybe all of a sudden you get the funding again to resume work. Well, you have to remobilize, and then there's kind of a demobilize and a remobilize, and a lot of those things can really add up. Interest rates, when you're able to buy things in a more of a lump sum, economies of scale kind of purchases, you diminish the role that inflation can have on that project. Well, you got to have funding certainty. You got to have long-term funding certainty for those kind of things. And, you know, again, so often Congress doesn't do that. State departments of transportation do a better job of long-term planning than the federal government does, and making sure that there's, you know, funding that's in alignment with their plan. You know, most state departments of transportation, they always have a 5-year planning horizon looking out their front windshield. But when 1 year expires, they add another year to the back of that 5 year plan. So they always kind of have a 5 year roadmap ahead of them. Well, Congress, they so often just work in very short term kind of planning and thinking, and that, and you know, there's real consequences of that when you're trying to build very expensive
things.
Yeah,
it puts you in a mode where you're mostly responding to emergencies as opposed to thinking about building and resilience.
Yeah, you know, it's just, you know, kind of the knee-jerk reaction kind of behavior that you too often see in Congress. You know, again, there's sometimes you do have to just immediately pivot and react, but, you know, being able to have that kind of long-term thinking is really important. And that kind of comes back to, you know, a comment that I've made over the years is, you know, the United States can increasingly be described as a spending nation, not an investing nation. And there's a big difference between the two. And it's all in a difference of mentality. When you spend, you're allocating resources today in exchange for value today or benefit today. When you invest, you're allocating resources today in exchange for value tomorrow. So you've got to have a willingness to defer some gratification. That's what's required to have an investment mentality, and we've all too often lost that.
Yeah,
in this country.
Generally speaking, that describes the nation and not just the issue with inland waterways. Let me ask you, how does the demand side of the market respond to these kinds of disruptions? How do the shippers respond? Are they loading barges light? Are they switching modes? Are they switching destinations?
Yeah, we saw, you know, with the low water conditions, you saw a variety of reactions to that. And you know, first of all, you know, the barge, the actual shipments on the river, they had to be reduced with less freight, and in our case, soybeans per barge, which again, that diminishes the economics of barge transportation. And then all of a sudden you had to go from, you had to reduce the number of barges that you can all attach together. So, say, going from 30 barges that you could attach together under normal conditions, say if you're going from St. Louis down south, to 20 barges. You know, a significant reduction. And so now all of a sudden you have the same amount of expense for propulsion, i.e. the towboat, you know, which the crew and all of the fuel involved with that, pushing a smaller amount of freight. And then so that diminishes the economics of it. Now, for farmers, it all kind of depended upon, some farmers have an option B, an option C, and an option D. Other farmers, they don't. So a lot of farmers that are located really close to the Mississippi River, their options are pretty much deliver to the river or deliver to the river, because that's really, it, year in and year out, it's a very attractive way to get your soybeans or your grain to market. Usually people who live close to the river are kind of the envy of other farmers because they're located adjacent to this very efficient maritime interstate system. But obviously when the river goes awry, they can really be challenged. And so they really didn't have a lot of options. They just kind of had to either keep their crops in storage, hope, waiting for the river to resume to some degree of normalcy, or, you know, sometimes you heard farmers just having to put their soybeans and grain on the ground, kind of in a temporary kind of storage arrangement. Other farmers, they might have an opportunity to, say, drive a longer distance to maybe access a livestock area where there's maybe a lot of poultry production or a lot of hog production where they can maybe feed into that particular market. It may not be their option. It's not their option A, but it's a pretty good option B for them. Or, you know, there might be a rail loading facility that may not be, again, their option A, but it's maybe their option C. So they were exploring that. So it really kind of depended upon where you're located, what kind of variety of options that you have. But again, our optimal arrangement was not available in the fall of last year, and it therefore had consequences.
So is rail a serious option? Is it not more costly?
It's more costly than barge transportation, but it is, for a certain area of the country, it is their only option. You know, a lot of key soybean and grain producing states, Nebraska and the North and South Dakotas and Western Minnesota, those kind of areas, they're not anywhere close to the inland waterway system, so rail is their option. A lot of that feeds into the Pacific Northwest, which is our number two export region after the Mississippi Gulf. So, you know, rail is integral to our success as well. And so you did have to see a lot of farmers and grain elevators all of a sudden have to, you know, consider rail more than they normally would. Of course, the problem last fall was there was a lot of uncertainty with rail in the form of, you know, the contract negotiations between the labor unions and the railroads. And that was providing a real pall of uncertainty over that industry as well. So we really were kind of hit with two significant challenges. One was on the inland waterway side, but also on the rail side. And so the net result of that is it put a big question mark on our industry. And, you know, one of the things that's most essential for industries to flourish is having predictability. And our supply chain was not really affording that last year.
So it seems to me that you're talking about predictability in a lot of settings, including the political process, predictability of resources, but predictability of the challenges associated with moving the product itself.
You know, predictability/reliability, it's more important than even the cost of transportation. It's more important than the speed of transportation. You know, people can adapt to if it's more costly or if it's not as fast as you normally would, you know, even though those are very important variables as well. But that reliability is really key to know I'm planning on it, on something arriving, you know, transportation service arriving on a particular day. I expect it to arrive at its destination on a certain day. And any kind of variability to that really starts raising concern among the industry. And so that's something that, you know, I really try to underscore, particularly talking to elected officials. Again, there's certain things that you just can't do, you know, like with a weather-induced event, that you have to react to that. You can't control that. But there's certainly a lot of areas where we're adding unreliability, a lack of predictability in our supply chain, and that has nothing to do with Mother Nature. It has to do with human behavior. And, you know, particularly from a government level, there's a lot that they can do to really enhance that predictability. And so that's a message we continue to convey.
I think it's a really important message, and we all have to work, all of us in the infrastructure business need to work together to keep the spotlight on that. Mike, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I really appreciate your giving us a bit of an education on this. We're going to track what you're doing and watch for your successes in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Good to talk to you. Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.